Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. We're very fortunate to have this tradition to practice with. We have friends from Vermont and California joining us and other places, and it's lovely how these monasteries that we have been a part of have a pretty similar kind of tradition and routine, and we can just come into them and feel at home and know the chanting and be a part of a larger community of practitioners. I think this is a great, great privilege we have. So you can go to a monastery in England or California or Perth, Australia, and just about the same kind of chanting. Monks look about the same. Same tradition. So tradition carries us as a community. Tradition isn't about individuals. There are individuals in a tradition, but tradition has a larger energy. Is like a vehicle that carries us. I like to talk about stress. Stress is a good modern thing to think about. See where I go with it. We have the kind of stress that is situational. So someone cuts you off on the highway, someone takes your parking spot, someone's aggressive at work, it's the middle of February and you want to go on vacation, you see an advert for a trip to Mexico. So there's things that that come to us that we don't want, and there's things that we want that we don't have. That's the pattern of contemplating stress. So things that come to you that you don't want, someone's aggressive, someone cuts you off in the traffic, that's stressful. And then in the middle of February, when it's actually February would be quite nice after all this rain. Some snow would be nice. Middle of February and you're at work and you want to get away and you see an ad for a trip to Acapulco or wherever people go. And it's very attractive, but you can't go there. So that's the stress of wanting something but not having it. So having something that you don't want and wanting something that you don't have. That's a good pattern to look at in our conscious experience. So there are types of stress which are just situational, that you handle however you handle them. They're very immediate. They're very obviously you're being stimulated in a positive or negative way by the situation. But from those kinds of stress also there can be reactions, stronger or weaker reactions. And those reactions obviously are more historical. So someone might just disagree with you in a very minor kind of, seemingly minor way, and you might blow up. You might really get defensive. Or something which is bigger than this particular input that you're experiencing. And so that's another kind of stress that we have, the stress of more kind of historical things coming up into consciousness. If the example I always like to give, if someone has just, was maybe they had a divorce, a bad divorce 2 years ago, and they've kind of worked through, as we say, they've worked through the the first 6 months of whatever, anger and rage and things like that, and then 2 years later they think they've worked it through, and then someone compliments their ex-partner, and then they get flared up again. That idiot, no, 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 no. That's historical, isn't it? And it's stress that comes out of us when situations press our buttons in a particular way. It's another way. And then I think a third way is just chronic, where we chronically abide in certain mind states that we have unfortunately become habituated to. Say, for example, let's say pessimism. I could be pessimistic about the outcome of a certain project which we are contemplating undertaking. So, well, I don't think it really work. Or, and that's just a kind of situational, natural pessimism, nothing wrong with that. Or I could be chronically pessimistic. Anything you say to me, I will always say, no way, this will never work. This is not going to work. It's a kind of chronic stress in the mind, because the mind always falls, like with the force of gravity, falls into a particular attitude which is unhealthy and unhappy. I might be concerned about the strength of a dam, the strength of the beaver dam, right? There's always too much water, and there's a report in the paper that the beaver dam had broken. So that kind of concern, I'm a bit anxious about it, that would be quite natural. But then also I could be chronically anxious about anything. It really wouldn't matter. The future would always be looming, and it always would be fearful. That would be chronic. I could be critical about some aspect of someone's behavior, then that's inappropriate. Or I could be chronically critical. No matter what happened, I would always be critical. Critical, critical. I could be concerned about some aspect of my own behavior. I could really, a bit of speech wasn't all right, great. Which would be quite a healthy kind of reflection. Or I could be chronically self-disparaging. So, I think we all can see that in our own consciousness and the consciousness of others. So there are these kind of chronic things which inhabit our consciousness, or we inhabit in consciousness. And these are very, very difficult, aren't they? Because they're so believable, because we have lived through their perspectives for so long. It can be so, so believable. And they're very hard to work out. They're very hard to work out. So the Buddhist approach to stress is first and foremost to make really clear intentions about living a good life. Do good, refrain from doing harm, purify the heart. A very simple structure, mantra that you can consider. Do good, refrain from doing harm, and purify the heart. And that's an intention we can make quite strongly. And we can make that very clearly in our minds. Do good, refrain from doing harm, purify that. You can do that every morning. You wake up and say, I will do my very best to not harm anyone, do my very best to follow those wholesome impulses, and when difficulty things come up, I'll work on them. And that helps. That helps a lot, just to make clear intentions about goodness. Because if you do that, if we make those clear intentions, then when other kinds of energies come, let's say if I make a clear intention to try to be a benefit to all sentient beings, I do that when I wake up in the morning. Today, I'll try to be a benefit to myself and all sentient beings. And then I'm not very beneficial to someone during the day. I do something in wrong speech, or something goes on which doesn't seem very, very beneficial. I can reflect and say, well, I didn't intend to do that. Now, I didn't wake up this morning with the intention of dumping this on someone. It's something deeper in me. It overcame mindfulness, and I have to work on that. I want to work on that. Right? So that intention is very, very helpful, because it's very easy to blame oneself for this kind of historical material that we all work through, for these chronic things that we all work through, it's very easy just to get, you think that, you know, I shouldn't have done that, I shouldn't have been like that, I shouldn't have felt that, but it doesn't work that way. Because we do have these forces and energies of karmic results that we're working on. So that helps, kind of clear intentions, just clear intentions to practice like precepts. So I can make a clear intention to speak in ways which are not divisive. I can make a clear intention to not harm sentient beings. I can make a clear intention to be honest in all my dealings in life. And that is a beautiful protection for these energies that come up. Beautiful protection, very important protection. So just the kind of clarity, and let's say if I tend to chronically enjoy gossip, I really enjoy kind of getting in there, and actually it's kind of destructive. And then I notice that, well, actually, when I talk this way, I divide this person against that person, this group against that group. Ooh, that's not good. I don't want to go there. So I make a clear intention that with speech, as much as possible, I'm not going to follow this pattern of divisive gossip. I'm not going to get drawn into that. I make that clear intention. And if I've been doing it for many years, I'll probably fail. But I can come back to that intention. So I can make mistakes. I can fail in my attempt to, say, practice right speech. But I can readdress that. I can reconfirm that. I can reassert my intention to, say, in this example, to not practice divisive speech. So then when I have this social construct in place, when I have ethics in place, when I have guardians at the gates, like saying, don't go there, don't follow that, then when this chronic material comes up or whatever, I'm doing two things. We were talking about this in the car with Keith, where I'm doing two things. I'm feeling I'm feeling this kind of gossipy energy which wants to divide for some curious reason, but there's something else in me that's saying, no way, I've got a higher standard. I've got this vehicle I'm traveling, and the vehicle's called Sila Samadhi Panya. And it's got precepts in it. So I'm doing two things. Feeling something, and yet I'm making intentions of non-harm, of non-divisiveness. And this is lovely. We can do this as human beings. And to do this, we need to adopt an attitude of inner listening. Inner listening is like a mirror. If I have a chronically bad posture, let's say I've had knee operations, and I've had two. We're talking about knee operations with Yanko. So I've had two knee operations, and when I had one knee operated on, I developed, and I still lean that way. I developed this real tilt to starboard, I think it is. Anyway, it's tilted way to the right. Because I was compensating. And after a while, it felt right. And then one day I looked in the mirror and said, whoa, where are you? You're way over there. And I still tend to drift that way, especially when I'm sleeping. So that's like the mirror then, right? The mirror reflects back and shows you, no, you might feel okay, but actually, you can get it to the left. Well, inner listening is a mirror, or inner reflection is the mirror of the mind, and it's a capacity we have to not only feel good things and bad things and so on, but actually to notice those feelings. And in inner listening, if we are listening to the voices of the mind, the thoughts, right? As Venerable Ajahn Tanisiro says, the kind of inner committee meeting that we all have, one committee member arguing with another committee member, all of that, we have this, that we notice that by inner listening, by inner attention, by inner vigilance, by mindfulness of these kind of inner voices. Now, inner listening isn't inner judgment. You know, it's not a critical function. It's an awakening function, isn't it? It's not like inner listening isn't a judgment about what you should be thinking. It's noticing what you are thinking. So it's an awakening factor. It's awakened mind. And And this needs to be cultivated. We constantly need to adopt an attitude of inner listening. So all the language that we have, you know, this is the way it is now, what's it like now, it's this way now, you hear it again and again and again. And it's simple language, but to actually continually awaken to the way things are is a practice. It's a practice, isn't it? One has to remember to remember. One has to remember to know. So then when this sort of inner listening becomes more and more constant and continuous, right, then one, what one notices is the quality of the inner voices, the quality of the inner dialogue, the quality of the inner speech and so on. And one notices that the inner dialogue is cut off, is driven by things. It's driven by certain kinds of energies or certain kinds of moods. And when we get, and we all can do that, can't we? And when we've made that step from believing in the storylines and narratives of our thinking mind and stepping back with this reflective capacity and inner listening and notice, well, this storyline is driven by anxiety or fear or criticism or aversion or whatever, we're practicing Dharma. That's one of the ways we define the practice of Dharma, because we're no longer just caught up in our ego formations and all that. We're seeing something deeper. We're seeing energies. We're seeing moods of the mind. And that's something more profound about human consciousness, isn't it? Something more profound than just believing any old thought pattern that comes up. So this kind of deepening of our attention and deepening of our understanding of ourselves gets us in contact with stress. more clearly in contact with stress. More clearly, we become more clearly aware of where these energies are arising from, the kinds of moods. So I begin to listen to my inner language and I see, well, actually, no matter what I do, I'm always worried I'll fail, let's say. Or, no matter what I do, I'm always self-critical. Or no matter what I do, I always want more. Or no matter what I do, my own mind always complains. I said, wow, look at that. So now the inner voices always have objects of fear or objects of complaint or objects of greed, right? Now, there's always someone I can complain about or something I can be anxious of. So they're endless kinds of things. But those underlying energies of chronic anxiety or chronic self-criticism, and I say, well, look at that. Look at that energy. That was there 2 minutes ago. Or it was there yesterday and yesterday and yesterday. Oh, I see. And this is insight. This is what we mean by insight. This is what vipassana means. It's just basically an insight into the workings of consciousness rather than just being a victim and a slave to the workings of consciousness. So you begin to get some real insight into how you're operating. And this is very personal. I mean, you can read books on Four Noble Truths and so on, but these patterns and things that we face, our own sort of kama vipaka that we face, is very personal. Very obviously. I mean, that's why it's a sort of do-it-yourself religion. You have to really understand yourself. And so the inner listening is also a willingness to explore and look at and allow things to be conscious in order to understand them. Inner listening, which would be wrong, would be just listening in order to get rid of something. Because that's quite, we just want to get rid of the suffering, get rid of the stress. But we need to take time to understand it. So in the Four Noble Truths, there is suffering. Suffering has to be understood. And there is stress. It has to be understood. And how can I understand it, but I'm willing to participate in it? I'm willing to feel it. I'm willing to explore it. And what's it really like? What's this really like? Now, each time I take this kind of step of inner listening, exploring, and paying attention, there's something that the awareness becomes like a larger field within which this stress is operating. When I'm simply caught up with the thoughts of, say, if I'm very judgmental of other people, and I'm just caught up with the judgments of other people, there's no real space of reflection. There's no mirroring. There's simply a driven thought pattern creating a reality which is actually causing me a lot of suffering, but it's just kind of going down the line of suffering. And then all of a sudden this inner listening saying, wow, this is really critical, look at that. And this space, right? This space, there's mirroring. And then from that space, things, even though they might be churning away, things are seen, things are noticed. And in that noticing, there's insight. So not only is there inner listening to the moods of the mind, like a mood. Moods are interesting, aren't they? If you know, what's it like a mood? If you're feeling blue, if you're feeling blue, it's a good. It's not pink. If you're feeling blue, all your perceptions change, don't they? You know, if you just lost your job, and your big toe or something. Right, you've got some kind of major stuff and your whole mood is changed by that, and everything changes. Your perception of nature, your perception of other people, your perception of yourself. Moods are really, they really color your life, don't they? Right? And then if I don't see that moods come and go, that colors of mind come and go, the tones of mind come and go, and that they're not ultimate reality, I can interpret things through that. I can make decisions from that. I think all of us, I know I have, I've made a lot of decisions from fear or shyness, which had been incorrect, to say the least. Kind of missed opportunities and failed possibilities. Why? Because I interpreted through delusion. And so the moods of the mind, when we're unaware of them, then perpetuate certain forms of stress and certain forms of unhappiness. So we can be aware of moods, and we can be aware of the thoughts that are stimulated by moods, or we can be aware, or we can be caught up by the thoughts that are stimulated by moods. Now, if we're just caught up with the thoughts stimulated by moods, we have no freedom. But if we start to do inner listening, if we listen carefully to what's going on, then the thoughts become symptoms of moods. Which is much more helpful, right? They're symptomatic, aren't they? You know, if I feel blue, I don't have happy, sunny thoughts. I have blue thoughts. So with inner listening, you begin to be able to use thought. You begin to have a way of insight vis-a-vis thought. That thought can provide insights into the mood. Whereas if there's no inner listening, the mood, one is enslaved to the moods. Driven by thought, right? So that kind of inner listening, then you wake up, wow, this is just really critical. This is really critical. Then you can make some choices, right? You're no longer just driven by the thinking that you say, well, that's really critical. So then you can shift your attention. You can shift it to the body. You can do inner listening on the body. So just as you can notice a mood, right? The mood affecting your thoughts. You can also notice the mood affecting your energy system. If you're anxious, it's different than if you're relaxed in your body and in your thoughts. Right? So you start to listen to the body as well. So inner listening isn't just about thinking, but it's a whole attitude of mirroring again. So the mirror then shows me the posture is off. The mirror shows me that this stress is creating a lot of stress in my body. Tension in my body. And I can make choices rather than choose or be chosen by unskillful thinking. I can use thought now and say, I wonder where that is in my heart or in my throat or in my body. Where is this mood? And so the whole pattern of stress begins to unravel. Why? Because I take the time to observe stress as a phenomenon of mind, of consciousness, a phenomenon of the heart, phenomenon of the body, rather than being something that I am. I am not that mood. That mood has arisen in consciousness. And this is very important, because if I simply believe in these moods, then they just create a sense of self, a sense of ego, and more suffering. But as soon as there's mirroring and inner listening, one begins to see that these are objects. They're clouds, they're rain, they're snow, they're nature's movement. And they begin to be understood as nature's movement. that's the beginning of freedom, isn't it? The kind of freedom to witness and notice the way things are. So as we begin to make choices, we can choose different kind of thoughts. We can evoke things from other parts of our psyche. We can evoke compassion, but it has to be done from wisdom. If I'm just trying to get rid of things and sort things out, it just becomes this kind of hit and miss affair. So wisdom is this kind of reflective capacity which shows us, oh, this is how it works. What if I try that? What if I try this? What if I say this to myself? Or what if I do some yoga? Or what if I go running? Or what if I just read Mad Magazine? Or whatever. You know, what if I just... But it's done from clarity rather than... it's done from experimenting, from clarity, from trying to understand yourself and then seeing what the effects are. And that's lovely. So one isn't no longer a victim to these things. Now these chronic kind of moods that I think probably a few of us participate in are very, very difficult because our sense of reality has been so conditioned by them. You know, our sense of what the world really is. So let's say if a person is very, very cynical, say, and very, very critical kind of mind, and they've been doing this for 20 or 30 years, right? Then that's their reality. And it seems very real. So the mind, so not only is there the initial history of that cynicism and so on, there's this whole weight of bad thinking, of bad habits, interpreting life through, in this sense, cynicism, or it might be where it might be anxiety. So the attitude has to be one, well, I'm going to work on this no longer how long it takes, no matter how long it takes. I want to be free from the stress, I want to understand it, and I'm going to work on it. Which isn't like self-disparagement, but it is like, it's like setting, it's being serious about the work and realizing the work does take time. It doesn't just sort of happen as some kind of religious experience and it's all finished. And as I always say with my teacher, Lajin Cha, I'd go to him with my chronic problems and he'd say, you just have to endure. Yeah, but... And there was no answer. There was no real answer. I just had to train and be with this. So there's a kind of willingness both to kind of feel what you have to work through, but also there's a kind of there is an optimism. There is an optimism. Why? Because the more you begin to have a kind of witnessing consciousness of this, you realize this isn't you. This is not your real self. Whereas when I believe in the thoughts, then I really think that I am an awful person, or I am an anxious person, or it is hopeless, or whatever. I believe in all that. That's who I really am. But that's not who we are. These are simply patterns of consciousness which are unskillful, within which awareness gets kind of caught up. So then as we understand the kind of chronic stress that, or different modes of stress that we experience as human beings, we have this kind of flexibility or dexterity in consciousness. You know, consciousness is quite wonderful, what we can do with our attention. We can move our attention. You can move your attention and evoke compassion, or you can move your attention and feel your big right toe. You can move your attention and think about daffodils, or you think about murder. Right? It's amazing what our a capacity to move our attention around. It's quite amazing. But if we've not really kind of developed that in a skillful way, our attention gets moved by events. So the guy cuts me off, and I feel anger, and then rather than say, oh, this is anger, this is a mood of anger, just be cool, be patient, I verbalize it, I give the guy the finger, and then I get road rage and we have an accident, we die. Or something like that. That's just being driven by things, isn't it? There's no freedom there. So freedom is, first and foremost, the capacity to know the way things are, and then from that knowing, making these really skillful choices. And what kind of skillful choices can we make? Well, we can reinvigorate our intentions to do good, refrain from doing harm. This is a beautiful intention. It's very, very powerful. Do good, refrain from doing harm. Purify the heart. Do good, refrain from doing harm. Purify the heart. And if you do it sincerely, you'll see, and we all do, we'll see more and more the subtlety of harm and the subtlety of goodness. You'll see, like what I try to do with my mother is I really try to, I take her, I help her get onto the balcony with all these lovely flowers if it's not raining, and she just blisses out, right, on all these flowers. She's really, and I even crouch down to her level. She's 4'10" now. She's shrunk 4 inches. And I just get down, it's even more lovely down at her level. Because it's, you know, I'm sort of up. Anyway, and then, you know, and what I'm talking about is the subtlety of goodness, is that quite often we do good things. You know, we do help people, and we do lovely things, but sometimes we don't cash in. So I like cashing on my mom. So I kind of, I really watch her enjoying herself. I said, well, that's why I've come, rather than being busy making the garden better. Guess what I can do? Just water things and sweep and tidy. Well, wait, what are you here for? I'm here to be, to see my mother being happy. So we can do that. We can bring in joy into our lives in all kinds of lovely ways, which we sometimes miss because we're so busy being good. Mm. or whatever it is. And just like to appreciate the your own generosity. I'm not being smarmy or it's not that kind of conceit of, oh, I'm generous, I'm like, great. It's not that. It's like when you serve someone, when you give to someone, when you help someone, when you've been kind to someone in some way, and they respond with a smile or whatever, really take that in. That's the payment. Might as well cash in. And appreciate that. And that kind of appreciation calms the mind, makes the heart happy. And learning to bring those sort of like just nature. You can do that with nature, can't you? If you can go out in the field and you've got to contend with the deer flies. But let's say in the autumn. Well, you look at like just color. And natural beauty, and let it come to you, and let your mind be rested by natural beauty, a kind of resting of the mind, appreciation of beauty. These are the kinds of things a busy culture sometimes doesn't allow for. But then you see, you're making choices also, not just for the alleviation of stress, but you're also making choices towards the enlivening of the heart through goodness, through joy, through compassion, and that enlivening quality becomes more and more strong. And it's not a function of craving, it's not a function of neurosis, it's a function of liberation. Compassion is a function of liberation. Liberated from what? Liberated from ego. When the ego sense falls away, what's left is the open heart and the capacity to appreciate, to act with compassion. That's just the natural function of a heart liberated from ego. So the more we remember those, the more we remember those give the heart and consciousness a kind of power, a kind of strength, and a kind of openness, which shows us the shutting down of chronic stress, of chronic anxiety, of chronic criticism, of chronic self-disparagement, all those different ways that we suffer from. This kind of enlivening of the heart through goodness. Through your good intentions, do good, refrain from doing harm. Through like precepts, through the Brahmaviharas, through the appreciation of your own goodness, all these things really enliven your practice in a way which then helps you a lot with the more difficult material that we all face. So it's not just like hanging out with your stuff. And sometimes it seems that way, I'm just working on my stuff. And it seems like such a, like Ajahn Sumedho said, it's like heart surgery without anesthesia. but there are ways of paying attention to life and of evoking things which are very enlivening, very, very opening. And we have that capacity too. So sometimes we just have to be, you know, we passively have to endure. There are times where something gets triggered and we just have to bear witness to it. We have to be very, very patient, let it come through, and that's fine. To fixing things all the time is also can be an endlessly frustrating kind of thing. So you don't have to fix anything, you just sometimes have to be with some kind of material. But if one is practicing inner listening, you'll see very clearly what's the difference between enduring something which has to come up and indulging in something which has come up. And it'll be in thought. If I've had a difficult encounter with someone and something gets triggered and I get a lot of emotion from that, the memory of that, I know darn well that's just material which I have to bear with. But if my mind starts indulging in self-disparagement or disparagement of the other person, revenge and so on, that's not it. That's attachment. And the mirror, inner listening, says, don't go there. Don't go there. And then you begin to see the difference between repression and indulgence. Repression is like pushing away. Indulgence is believing in the storyline. And the middle way is, this is the way it is now. And so difficult material can come up and we can make choices from clarity. So the spiritual path is very, it has a kind of creative side to it, you know, a creative side where each of us has our own history and our own, like your mom says, our own curriculum that we're all studying, and then within that we if we just have the patience to listen, we'll see things to do, we'll try things, and the good results come from that. All right, I'll leave that for reflection today.
Andhamayam namakathaya sadhankaram dadamase sadhu 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 anumodaya.